and I set up our tent with its square canopy where Randall could dress and preen. Suzette and Josie loved having a male dancer to fuss over and kept asking Cappy and me when we were going to start. Cappy had danced until he was 10 years old. "I'm making you a new grass dance outfit," Josie shook her finger at him. Cappy just smiled at her. He never said no to anyone. He and Rando had cut young popple saplings on their land, and we set up a cooling arbor where the aunties could take the breeze. The day was heating up, and their beaded yokes and tanned hides, the bone breastplates and the woolen shawls, the heavy silver concho belts and figured ornaments, and all that long leather fringe must have weighed 60 pounds or more. Suzette and Josie were round but phenomenally strong, so they could move with dignity under the weight of all this tradition and not collapse. Randall was hardly weighed down by all contrast, but he was covered with so many feathers, Cappy said, it looked like he'd rolled in a flock of eagles. He had a pair of red long johns with aprons or breechcloths that hung fore and aft. "Be sure you get your modesty panel set just right," said Cappy. "You don't want anyone to know what you ain't got." "Shut up, Bobtail," he said to Cappy. "And don't you even start, Shrimpy," he said to me. He held up a mirror and painted 2 black stripes down his forehead to his eyebrows, then continued underneath his eyes and down his cheeks. Rando's eyes suddenly became impenetrable warrior eyes. He glowered at us from under his guard hair roach and swaying feathers. "Give us your smolder," said Cappy. "That was it," said Rando. "Observe its effect." He went out into the sunlight and stretched beside the cotton candy vendor's trailer. Rando said his red long johns were traditional, but Cappy and I thought they ruined his look. A girl in a leather halter top leaned away from her friends, sipping soda through a straw. She watched all kissy face as Randall practiced his moves. He put his foot up on the trailer's hitch and strained to touch his toes like he was stretching his hamstrings. He did this twice, and on the third time cracked a boogit. He tried to saunter off as though it hadn't happened. The girl laughed so hard she choked and spurted her pop. "Learn from the masters," said Cappy. "Whatever Randall does, do the opposite." Angus's family was there, spilling out of and around a car, so we went to get him and find Zack. When we were all 4 together, we needed fry bread, went and got some, and were eating in the shade of the stands when some girls from school came up to us. They always talked to Angus first, then Zack, then me, then focused on their real target, Cappy. The girls from our year were mainly named some version of Sean. There was Shauna, Donna, Shawnee, Donnelly, Shalana, and just plain Don and Sean. There was also a girl named Margaret, named after her grandmother who worked at the post office. I ended up talking to Margaret. Don, Sean, and the others had their hair curled back from their faces and sprayed stiff. Eyeshadow, lip gloss, 2 pairs of earrings in each ear, tight jeans, little striped T-shirts, and shiny silver necklaces. I tease Margaret to this day about what she wore to that powwow. That's because I remember every detail, down to the silver locket that contained not a photo of her boyfriend, but a picture of her baby brother. What Cappy did to attract girls was just be Cappy. He didn't smolder like Randall. He didn't wear a single feather. He was dressed as usual in a faded T-shirt and jeans. His hair naturally fell down over one eye, and he didn't bother tucking it behind his ear, but used that head toss. Otherwise, he just talked and drew us all in. The thing I noticed was he asked the girls about themselves, almost like a teacher would. How their summer was going, what their families were doing. The conversation put us on an easy footing and we walked, circling the arena behind the stands. The girls being noticed. Us noticing them being noticed. We went around a few times. The girls bought cotton candy. They peeled off strips of fluff for us. We drank pop and tried to crush the cans in our fists. Things started up. Veterans brought in the American flag, the MIA POW flag, the flag of our tribal nation, our traditional eagle staff. The head dancers followed, and then the grand entry dancers lined up and moved into the arena by category, all the way down to the tiny tots. We stood on the top tier to watch it all. The drums, the rousing synchrony of bells, rattles, deer clackers, and the flashing music of the jingle dancers. Grand entry always caught my breath. It made me step along with the dancers. It was big, contagious, defiant, joyous. But tonight, all I could think of was how to grab my pack and slip away. I went as the crow flies, took the wood pass, crossed a couple of pastures, cut down the back roads. When I got to the house, there was still light. The outdoor dog barked at me and recognized me. "Hey, Fleck," I said, and he licked my hand. We waited half an hour behind the shed until dusk. I waited for a while after that, until it was really dark, and then I put on a pair of my mother's leather gloves, tight ones, and walked up to the back door carrying the crowbar Cappy had left out. When I jimmied the door, the indoor dog barked, but she wagged her tail when I entered and followed me to the gun cabinet. The shatter of glass startled her, but she whined with excitement when I took out the gun. She thought we were going hunting. Instead, I put ammunition in my backpack, messed up the TV, scattered the toolbox, then said goodbye to the dogs. I walked across the road and found the path Cappy and I had marked out. I had to use my flashlight but switched it off when a car crested the rise on the gravel road. Up near the overlook, we already made the hole. I wrapped the rifle and ammo tight in the garbage bags and buried it, scattered leaves, brush, twigs back over the top. At least by the light of a three-quarter moon, the place looked undisturbed. I drank some water and started walking back to the powwow grounds. I went back along the same paths, around the same sloughs, down the old two-track dirt roads, the wood paths that a few still cleared to log out their firewood. I crossed a horse pasture and could hear the drums from there, still going, now 49 songs and moccasin games. People stayed awake all night gambling in some of the tents. I made it back to our tent and unzipped the bug-proof screen. Cappy was awake. Randall gone. Cappy asked me how it went. "Smooth," I said. "I think it went smooth." "Good," he said. We lay on our backs, awake. Doe would have gone home by now and found his house broken into, his rifle gone. He'd have to call the BIA tribal police. There wasn't any way he'd know it was me. But I didn't know how I could face him anyway. Mornings were always the best times, waking with the cool air stirring along the fabric walls, smelling coffee, bannock, eggs, and sausage. Outside, sun and fresh alfalfa cut for the horses. Suzette and Josie were making their plans for the day and feeding their grandchildren on flimsy paper plates, which always bent or disintegrated beneath the load of food. "Aye, here, put another plate underneath you." The children walked hunched over to the edge of the grass and ate close to the ground. Every bite was good. The sisters had a Coleman gas stove and a propane tank. They fried bacon and cooked bannock with the grease. The scrambled eggs were light, fluffy, never burnt. Bread was toasted on a hot griddle. There was an open jar of Juneberry jam, another of wild plum. They knew how to feed boys. A couple hours after hot breakfast, there was cold breakfast, watermelon, cereal, cold bannock, soft butter, and meat. They owned a magnificent blue-speckled enameled tin coffee pot, and a stainless steel one, too, just for tea. The lawn chairs at the camp were always full of gossipy men, and the RV started out crawling with children until one of the sisters put a stop to it and locked them out. After cold breakfast, the sisters made piles of sandwiches, stashed them in the cooler under supervision of their daughters. They retired into the RV to prepare themselves for the day's grand entry. Nothing could disturb them. Not pleased to use their bathrooms, screams of vengeance from fighting boys, or their daughters feigned panic. The scent of burning sweetgrass wafted from the little pull-down screen windows. Suzette and Josie took their regalia very seriously and made sure all of the bad looks from other women, the grudged thoughts or snapping eyes, were removed from their cloth and beads by the smoke. And their own thoughts, too, perhaps, for their husbands' eyes were known to roam, although they had no proof. The interior of the RV, so cunningly fitted with cabinets and fold-up beds, drawers, cupboards, hidden chests, a tiny toilet, was neatened and perfected. When they emerged, one of them padlocked the door shut from the outside and stashed the key in the beaded striker purse or knife sheath that hung from her belt. They moved off in unison, their hair braided long with mink pelts, gray only at the temples. Grandly, gracefully, they entered the flow of the dancers. Their buckskin fringe swayed with dreamlike precision. Everybody liked to watch them, to see if they'd be thrown off by the swirl of intertribal when anybody and everyone entered the arena. Little boys in half a grass dance outfit copied big boy moves and knocked against Suzette and Josie. Little girls with eyes glazed in concentration jingle-hopped after their glamorous sisters and tripped into their path. Suzette and Josie did not falter. They talked to each other, broke into laughter, never missed a beat or disrupted the even sway of fringe on their sleeves, shawls, and yokes. "Two skins for each dress," said Cappy, "and probably another skin's worth of fringe. If they fell on top of each other, they'd get snarled up and never break apart." "Come on down, all you spectators," called Doe. "This is intertribal. Put your feet on the ground and whatever you got. Boots, moccasins, even hippie sandals. What are those?"
"Birkenstocks," somebody tells me.
"We found a Birkenstock outside of Rando's tent last night."
"Oh, yes.
Oh, wow." Doe was always teasing Rando and his friends about their continual efforts at snagging women.
"Fuck," said Rando behind us. "Some fuckers broke into our house last night and stole one of Dad's deer rifles."
"They get anything else?" said Cappy. He didn't turn around to look at Rando, but frowned out at the dancing.
"Nah," said Rando. "That rifle shows up. I'll cold cock somebody."
"How's Doe taking it?"
"He's mad," Randall shrugged.
"But not that mad. He says it's odd they just took that one rifle. They might have tried to take the TV, drop the toolbox. Amateurs. Couldn't find any tracks or nothing. Drug heads."
"Yeah," said Cappy.
"Yeah," I said. "Either the dogs weren't doing their jobs or they knew who did it. Or somebody could have thrown them a piece of meat," said Cappy.
Randall made a disgusted noise. Wasn't his favorite rifle anyway. If they got his favorite, he'd be mad.
"That's good," I said. I felt so low I wanted to slide under the bleachers and crouch there with the dead cigarettes, melted snow cone wrappers, balled up diapers, and brown splats of spit snooze.
"From now on, we're going to keep the house better locked," Cappy said.
"I'm going home tonight," said Rando, "sleeping on the couch with my shotgun until we fix the door."
"Don't shoot your nuts off," said Cappy.
"Don't worry, Nutless. Fuckers show up to finish the job, they'll be sorry."
"You're the man," said Cappy.
He clapped his brother's shoulder and we sauntered off. We walked around and around the arena. After a while, he clapped my shoulder too.
"You did it smooth."
I hate myself, though.
"Brother, you must get over that," said Cappy. "He will never know. But if he did know, Doe would understand."
"Okay," I said after a while. "But when I do it, the rest of it, I do it alone."
Cappy sighed. "Listen, Cappy," I said, hoarse, nearly whispering. "I'm going to call this like it is. Murder, for justice, maybe. Murder just the same. I had to say this 1,000 times in my head before I said it out loud, but there it is, and I can take him." Cappy stopped. "Okay, you said it, but that's not the whole point. If you ever hit 3 cans in a row, just once, I'd say maybe, but Joe, I'll get close to him. He'll see you. Worse, you'll see him. You got one chance, Joe. I'll just be there to steady your mind, your aim. I won't get implicated, Joe." "Okay," I said out loud. No way, I thought. I had decided I would not tell Cappy what morning I was going to the Overlook. I would just go there and do it. The weather the first part of that week was forecast clear and hot. Linda had said her brother played early, before anybody else was out. So just after sunrise, I rose and sneaked downstairs. I told my parents that I was getting in shape for fall cross country. And I did run. I ran the woods trails where I would not be seen. I was getting good at skirting yards and using windbreaks for cover. I took a washed-out pickle jar of water in one hand and a candy bar in my shirt pocket. I made sure the stone Cappy gave me was in my jeans pocket. I wore a brown plaid shirt over a green T-shirt, the best I could do for camouflage. When I got to the Overlook, I scraped the sticks and leaves away and set them aside. Then I took the earth off the gun in the bags and set that aside too. I took the rifle out of the bags and loaded it. My fingers shook. I tried deep breaths. I wrung my hands and brought the rifle to the oak tree, sat down and held it. I put the jar of water next to me, then I waited. I would see any golfer on the 5th tee well before he came to the place where I planned to shoot. Then while Lark was starting down the fairway behind a screen of young pine trees, I would walk down the hill with the rifle and hide behind a riffle of chokecherry bush and box elder. From there, I'd aim and wait until he got close enough. How close he came would depend on where he hit the ball and in which way it rolled, where he stood the putt and other things. There were many variables, so many that I was still weighing possibilities when the sun got so high I knew I'd been sitting there for hours. Once the regular stream of golfers began, I got up and unloaded the rifle. I packed it in its bag. I rolled the other bag around it, reburied it, and scattered the leaves and twigs over the ground. On the way home, I ate the candy bar and put the wrapper in my pocket. My stomach had stopped jumping. Done for the day, I felt almost euphoric. I drank the last of the water and carried the empty jar along and didn't think. I looked at every tree I passed, and it amazed me with its detail and life. I stopped and watched two horses browse in a weedy pasture, born graceful. When I got home, I was so cheerful that my mother asked what had got into me. I made her laugh. I ate and ate. Then I went upstairs and fell asleep for an hour and woke into the same great wash of dread I began with every time I woke up. I'd have to do the same thing tomorrow morning, and I did. As I sat against the oak tree, there were moments I forgot why I was there. I would get up to leave, thinking I was crazy. Then I remembered my mother stunned and bleeding in the back seat of the car, my hand on her hair, or how she had stared from her bed covers, as if from a black cave. I thought of my father helpless on the linoleum floor of the grocery. I thought of the gas can in the lake, on the hardware store shelf. I thought of other things. Then I was ready. But he did not show up that Tuesday. He did not show up on Wednesday either. On Thursday, rain was forecast. So I thought maybe I'd stay home. I went anyway. Once I got to the Overlook, I went through all of the actions that have become routine by now. I sat under the oak tree with the rifle, safety on, the water beside me. There was low cloud cover, and the air smelled like rain. I had been there for maybe an hour, waiting for the clouds to break.
when Lark walked on to the tee dragging his clubs in a stained, old canvas-wheeled cart. He disappeared behind the planted pines. Cradling the rifle the way Cappy had taught me, I stepped down the hill. I told myself exactly what to do so often that at first I thought I'd be all right. I found a spot marked out just at the edge of the bushes where I could stand, nearly hidden. From there I could sight and aim just about any place Lark might be on the green. I thumbed off safety. I gulped in air and let it out explosively. I held the rifle gently the way I'd practiced and tried to control my breathing, but each breath got stuck, and there was Lark. He hit from a low rise near the pine trees. The ball arced and landed at the edge of the clipped circle with a bounce that took it another yard toward the hole. Lark walked down quickly. The scent of minerals began to seep out of the earth. I brought the rifle to my shoulder and followed him with the barrel. He stood sideways, staring down at his golf ball, squinting his eyes, opening them, squinting again. Completely absorbed, he wore tan pants, golf shoes, a gray cap, and a brown short-sleeved t-shirt. He was so close I could read the logo of his defunct grocery store, Vinland. The golf ball rolled to a spot half a foot from the hole. He'd tap it in, I thought. He'd bend over to scoop it out. When he straightened up, I'd shoot. Lark walked forward. And before he could tap it in, I shot at the logo over his heart. I hit him someplace else, maybe in the stomach, and he collapsed. There was a loud silence. I lowered the rifle. Lark rolled over on his knees, staggered to his feet, found his balance, and began to scream. The sound was a high squeal like nothing I'd ever heard. I got the rifle back to my shoulder, reloaded. I was shaking so hard I rested the barrel on a branch, held my breath, and shot again. I couldn't tell where that shot went. Once again I worked the bolt, reloaded, aimed, but my fingers slid off the trigger. I couldn't shoot. Lark pitched forward. There was another silence. My face was drenching wet. I wiped my eyes on my sleeve. Lark began to make noise again. Please, no, please. No, I thought I heard those words, but I could have said them. Lark was trying to get up again. He pedaled one foot in the air, rolled over, onto his knees, and rose in a crouch. He locked eyes with me. Their blackness knocked me backward. The rifle was lifted from my arms. Cappy stepped forward beside me. I didn't hear the shot. All sound, all motion had stalled in the sullen air. My brain was ringing. Cappy picked up the ejected casings from around my feet and put them in the pockets of his jeans. Come on, he said, touching my arm, turning me. Let's go. I followed him uphill in the first drops of rain. Chapter 11. The Child. At the oak tree, we turned and looked down. Lark was lying on his back, the golf clubs neatly waiting in their cart. His putter cast down at his heels. He hadn't moved. Beside me, Cappy dropped to his knees. He leaned over until his forehead touched the earth and put his arms over his head like a child in a tornado drill. After a while, he lifted his head and shook it. We wrapped the rifle back up in its bag and set it aside as we tried to restore the ground where it had been buried. Cappy used a branch to brush up the grass I had trampled.
Nobody's home at my place, said Cappy. We gotta hide this. He had the rifle.
We waited until a passing car was out of sight before we crossed the road. Now the rain was misting down. When we got to Cappy's, we went straight to the kitchen tap. We washed our hands, put water on our faces, and drank glass after glass of water. I should have thought of where to hide it, I said. I don't know why I didn't think of this. I don't know why I didn't either, said Cappy. He went and rummaged around on the junk-laden coffee table until he came up with a set of keys. Doe had taken his car to work, and Randall had gone off in his pickup. But Randall also had the red beater Olds that Cappy tinkered with. It had a black driver's side door and a cracked windshield. We went out, put the rifle in the trunk, and got into the front. "The starter's bad," said Cappy. It'd grown the first time he turned it over. He gave it a spurt of gas. It died. "You gotta sneak up on it," Cappy said. "While I'm psyching out this car, you think of where we're going."
"I know where we're going."
He tried again. It nearly caught.
"Where are we going?"
"To Linda's.
To the old Wishcob homestead."
We sat back, looking out at the shed, through the two halves of the windshield.
"That makes weird sense," said Cappy.
Suddenly he leaned forward, cranked the key hard, and pumped the gas pedal.
"Engage," he said.
The engine roared. The rain was coming down, like 60 now. Cappy opened his window and craned his neck to peer out as he drove. The windshield wiper worked on the passenger side, but not the driver's side. He drove slowly and sedately as an old man. The Wishcob land was at the other end of the reservation in the dune-like brown hills of grass that were mostly good for grazing. It was a nice old place with plantings of lilac and a few twisted oak, battered shrubs that could stand the heavy wind. On the way there, we'd passed maybe two cars, and there was nobody to see us turn into Linda's Drive. The place was isolated. Cappy eased the car into park and kept it idling because he didn't know if it would start again. We got out and walked around the house to decide where. Linda's old dog set up an asthmatic barking inside the house. We ended up pulling off a piece of tan latticework tacked to the underside of Linda's front porch. I crawled in and shoved the gun as far back as I could. We used a tire iron to pound the lattice back in place. Then we noticed all the lattice was gone on the other side where the dog liked to sleep. We got back in the car and pulled out. We didn't talk. Cappy paused the car to let me out on the road to my house. On the upper road leading out of town, we saw the tribal police car driving east toward the golf course, lights going, no siren.
"He's dead for sure," said Cappy.
"Otherwise, they'd rock it.
Their sirens would be going off."
We sat in the idling car. The rain was hardly a sprinkle now.
"You saved my ass, brother."
"Not really.
You would have shot that."
Cappy stopped. "Around here we don't speak badly of the dead," and he caught himself. "He would have died, though," I said.
"You didn't kill him. This is not on you."
"Sure. Okay." We were speaking without emotion, like we were talking of other people, or as if what we did had just happened on television. But I was choking up. Cappy swiped at his face with the heel of his palm.
"We can't talk about it after this," he said.
"Affirmative. Isn't that how your dad says people get caught, bragging to their friends?
They get drunk, whatever."
"I feel like getting drunk," Cappy said.
"With what?"
The car's idle faltered, and Cappy pressed tenderly on the gas pedal.
"I don't know. Rando's on the wagon." "I can make it up with Whitey," I said.
"Yeah?" Cappy glanced at me. I nodded at him and looked away.
"After you bring the car back."
"Right.
Meet me at the gas station. I'll go talk to him."
I got out. I stood away from the car, then reached out and hit my palm on the window. Cappy drove off, and I walked slowly over to the gas station. Past the old BIA school and the community center, past the one-stop sign, and past Clements and Edwards' house. Over the highway and down the weedy ditch and back up. By the time I got there, the rain had completely dried off except for some random dark patches on the gravel or cement. Whitey stood in the doorway of the garage wiping his hands on the greasy rag. He watched me for a moment and then faded back into the darkness. Came out dangling two cold open bottles of grape crush. I walked up to him and took a bottle. His receiver was crackling police signals. I took a gulp of pop, and it nearly came back up.
"Your stomach must be turned over," said Whitey. "You need a slice of bread."
He got me some white bread from the cooler, and after I ate a slice, I felt better. We sat down in the lawn chairs in the shadow the garage cast, where Sonia and LaRose had sat what seemed a very long time ago.
"Remember when I was little?" I asked. "You used to give me a swig now and then."
"Your mom sure hated that," said Whitey.
"Hungry? Fancy a res steak sandwich?"
"Not yet," I said. I sipped the grape pop.
"This time it went down good," said Whitey.
He was looking at me closely. He opened his mouth a couple of times before he spoke.
"Someone dusted Lark," he said. "On the golf course. Made a mess of him, like a kid shooting at a hay bale. Then one clean headshot."
I tried to sit very still, but couldn't. I jumped up and ran around back. I just got there in time. Whitey didn't follow me. He was helping a customer when I came back. My knees were weak as water, and I needed the lawn chair.
"I'm switching you to ginger ale, my boy." He went into the store and came out with a warm can. "This ain't been in the cooler, and it should go easy on your gut."
"I think I got a summer flu."
"The summer flu," he agreed. "It's going around. Your friends catch it, too?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen them."
Whitey nodded and sat down beside me. "I've been listening to the squawk box. Whoever did it left no traces," he said. "There's nothing to go on. Nobody's seen it. Nobody's seen nothing. Then it rained so hard. You'll be getting over this flu quickly. Still, maybe you should take a lay down, Joe. There's a little cot in the office. Sonia used to nap there, and she will again. She's coming home, Joe, I tell you."
"Did she call you?" I asked, hating him.
"Damn right she called me. Gonna be different now," she said. "Her game, but I don't care. I don't care. Whatever you think."
He looked away from me carefully.
"I'm stone in love with that old girl. You understand? She's coming back to me, Joe."
I walked in and lay down on a cot for a good half hour. It didn't smell like Sonia. I was glad because I couldn't have taken that. When I got up and went back out, Cappy still had not shown up.
"I could maybe eat that sandwich now, Uncle."
Whitey went to the cooler and took out the bologna, cheese, and bread. There was a head of iceberg lettuce in there, and he carefully tore off 3 pale green leaves and placed them on the meat before closing the sandwich.
"Lettuce?" I asked. "I'm on a health kick, me."
He handed over the sandwich and made one for himself. Then he gave me that one, too.
"Your friend's here."
Cappy came in the door, and I handed him a sandwich. The three of us went back outside and ate, sitting in the lawn chairs.
"Uncle," I said, "we could use a little something."
He ate his whole sandwich.
"I don't wonder,"
he said when it was gone.
"But if you tell Geraldine or Doe, it is my saggy old red ass on the line here, plus any future supply of stuff for you. And you have to drink it out back behind the station in those shade trees where I can keep my eye on the both of yous.
We'll abide by your conditions," said Cappy in a formal tone. His face was expressionless.
"Handle the trade," said Whitey.
There was no one in sight. He went back to open the safe, where he kept his booze. He brought out half a quart of Four Roses and pointed it toward the trees. Cappy took the bottle and put it underneath his shirt. A customer pulled up. Whitey waved and walked over to the car.
"Does he know?"
"I think so," I said. "I puked when he told me about Lark."
"I puked riding over here," said Cappy.
"It's just the summer flu," I said.
"Is that a medical opinion, Joe?"
We looked at each other and tried to smile. But instead our mouths dropped open. Our faces fell into our real expressions.
"What are we?" asked Cappy. "What are we now?"
"I don't know, man. I don't know.
Let's sterilize our insides."
"Right on." Beneath the tree there were four or five cement blocks, a litter of crushed cans, a circle of ash. We sat down on the blocks and opened the bottle. Cappy took a cautious drink and handed it to me. I took a fiery mouthful and let it trickle down. The burning mellowed as the stuff reached inside of me, loosening my chest with a slow warmth and easing my gut. After the next sip, I felt better. Everything looked amber. I took my first deep breath. "Oh," I said, bowing my head and passing the bottle back to Cappy. "Oh, oh, oh."
"Yes?"
said Cappy. "Oh." He drank more deeply. I picked up a branch and scraped the bits of charred wood and speckled gravel away from the ash, destroying the circle. Cappy watched the movements of my branch, and I kept moving the branch until we finished the bottle. Then we lay down in the weeds.
"Brother," I said, "what made you come to the Overlook?"
"I was always there," said Cappy. "Every morning. I always had your back." "I thought so," I said. And then we slept. After we woke up, Whitey made us rinse out our mouths, gargle with mouthwash, and eat another sandwich. "Give me your shirt, Joe," he said. "Leave it here. Touch the bottle again. You too, Cappy." I gave him my shirt and walked home. Cappy coasted beside me. We did not feel particularly drunk. We did not feel anything. But we wove from side to side on the road, unable to keep on a straight course. We thought that Angus and Zack would be looking for us.
"We should all four be hanging out all the time now, together," said Cappy. "We'll keep training for cross-country in the morning."
"That's right." Pearl came out from beneath her bush and walked with me up to the house. Before I went in the door, I played with her and made myself laugh. I took her inside with me because I was afraid that my parents would be sitting at the kitchen table waiting for me, as indeed they were. When I opened the door and saw them, I bent over and rubbed Pearl's neck and talked to her. I stood up to greet them and let the smile drop off my face.
"What?"
I said. Whitey's booze had settled inside of me by then, separating me from who I was, say, when I dug those seedlings out of the foundation, when I had wept outside my mother's bedroom door, when I had watched the angel, my dudum, cross the sun-grazed walls of my bedroom. I knelt down with my arm around Pearl's neck and disregarded my parents' endless stare. I stayed across the room, hoping that they would not smell me, but I felt my mother look at my father.
"Where were you?"
asked my mother.
"Running." "All day?"
"At Whitey's, too." Some small thing eased between them.
"Doing what?"
"Just hanging out. Whitey fed us lunch, me and Cappy. They wanted to believe me so much that I saw they'd make every effort to believe. All I had to do was stay plausible, not break, not puke.
"Sit down, son," said my father.
But although I drew a step closer, I did not take a chair. He told me Lark was dead. I let all my feelings cross my face.
"That's good," I finally said. "Joe," said my father, his hand on his chin, his eyes on me. The weight intolerable. "Joe, do you know anything, even the slightest thing about this?"
This what?"
"He was murdered, Joe."
But I'd used the word before. I'd hardened myself. I used it with Cappy, and I used it in my head. I had prepared to answer this question, and to answer it the way the old Joe from before this summer would answer. I spoke childishly, in a sudden fury of excitement that wasn't fake.
"Dead?"
"I wanted him dead, okay?
In my thoughts. If you're telling me he's murdered, then I'm happy. He deserved it. Mom is free now.
You're free.
The guy who killed him should get a medal.
All right, my father said. Enough. He pushed back his chair. My mother's eyes did not leave my face. She was intent on believing anything I said. But she shuddered all over suddenly. A ripple passed over her body. The shock of it reached me. She sees the murderer in me, I thought. Dizzy, I reached down for Pearl, but she had crept to my father's leg. I sat back up. I won't lie. I'm glad he's dead. Can I go now? I walked past them and continued until I reached the stairs. I carefully took the steps. As I went up, drawn in my weariness, as if by a rope, I felt their eyes on me. I recalled this happening before at some time and me watching. I was halfway to my room before I remembered my mother climbing to that place of loneliness from which we feared she never would descend. No, I thought, as I crept into my bed. I've got Cappy and the others. I've done what I had to do. There is no going back. And whatever happens, I can take.
I was down. I was sick for real now, with the summer flu, just as I had pretended. Whitey vouched for us. When first Vince Medwayson, then another tribal police officer, then finally Agent Berkey pressed him. Whitey gave up that we'd gotten into his booze stash and passed out behind the station. He showed them our hideout in the weeds, the bottle, which was fingerprinted, and my shirt. My mother identified it as the one she'd washed for me to wear that day. But the rifle, Doe's 30-06. I was running a fever of alternating sweats and chills, and my sheets were sodden. While I was ill, I watched the golden light pass across my walls. I could feel nothing, but my thoughts ran wild. Always I kept going back to the day I dug the trees out of the foundation of our house. How tough those roots had clung. Maybe they had pulled out the blocks that held our house up. And how funny, strange, that a thing can grow so powerful even when planted in the wrong place. Ideas, too, I muttered. Ideas. Dad's case law, the Cohen, and then that hot dish. I think of the black noodles. The noodles became a carcass, the human, the buffalo, the body subject to the laws. I'd wonder how my mother got her spirit to return to her body, and if it had returned, and if mine was fleeing now because of what I'd done. Would I become a Wendigo, infected by Lark? And it occurred to me how even pulling trees that day, just months ago, I was in heaven, unaware. I had known nothing even as the evil was occurring. I hadn't been touched yet. Thinking finally exhausted me. I turned over away from the light and slept.
Dad, I said once, when he came into the room, does Linda know? Is she okay? He brought me a glass of Whitey's Cure, warm ginger ale. I don't know, he said. She won't pick up her telephone. She's not at work. I've got to get to her, I thought. And then I slept hard again until late the next morning.
When I woke from that sleep, everything was clear. I had no fever, no sickness at all. I was hungry. I got up and took a shower. Put fresh clothes on and came downstairs. The trees at the edge of the yard swayed and the leaves showed their dull, silvery undersides. I ran myself a glass of tap water and stood at the kitchen window. My mother was outside, kneeling in the dirt of the garden with a colander, picking the bush beans that my father and I had planted late. She dropped down and crawled the roll on all fours sometimes. Sat back on her heels. She gave the colander a little jounce to settle the beans. That's why I did it, I thought. And I was satisfied right then, so she could give her colander a shake. She didn't have to look behind her or fear he would sneak up on her. She could pick her bush beans all day and nobody was going to bother her. I poured out a bowl of cereal and added milk. I ate it slowly. The cereal felt good going down. I rinsed my bowl and went outside. My mother got up and walked over to me. She put her stained palm on my forehead.
Your fever's gone?
I'm fine now.
You should take it easy. Just stay home and read, or...
I won't do much, I said. It's just that school starts up in 2 weeks. I don't want to waste any of my last days.
I guess they would sure go to waste if you stayed home with me.
She wasn't angry, but she didn't smile. I didn't mean it that way, I said. I'll come back early.
Her eyes, one sadder than the other with its sinking squint, moved softly over me. She pushed back my hair. I looked over her shoulder and saw an empty pickle jar sitting on the kitchen step. I froze.
The jar?
I'd left the jar on the hill.
What's that?
She turned around. Vince Medwayson came by. He gave me the jar and said to wash it out. He said he likes my home-canned pickles. I guess it's a hint. She looked back at me closely, but I didn't change my expression.
I am worried over you, Joe.
There was a moment I still linger on in my thoughts. Her standing before me in the riot of growth. The warm earth smell of her hands. A slick of perspiration on her neck. Her searching eyes.
Whitey said you boys got drunk.
It was an experiment, I said, and the results came back negative. I wasted good vacation being sick, Mom. I think my drinking days are done. She laughed in relief, and the laugh stuck in her throat. She said she loved me, and I mumbled back at her. I looked down at my feet.
Are you okay now? I asked, low.
Oh, sure, my boy. I'm really good. I'm back to myself. Everything is fine now, fine. She tried to persuade me. At least he's dead, Mom. He paid, whatever else.
I wanted to add that he did not die easy, that he knew what he was getting killed for, that he saw who was killing him. But then I'd have to say it was me.
I couldn't look at her and got my bike. I rode away with her silent gaze heavy on my back. First, I rode over to the post office. There was a chance I might run into Dad if it was lunchtime, so I wanted to slip in before noon and see if Linda was working. She was not. Margaret Nanopush, the grandma of the Margaret in my class at school, the girl at the powwow I turned out to marry, told me that Linda was using up some sick leave. As far as Mrs. Nanopush knew, she was at home, so I went there. I was weak enough to feel that ride is endless. Out on that edge of the reservation, the wind cuts hard. I pedaled against its flow for a good hour before I came to Linda's road, and then finally swerved into her driveway. Linda's car was parked in a wooden carport. She drove, surprising to say, a cute blue Mustang. I remembered that she said she enjoyed taking to the road. I leaned my bike against her porch. I am winded. I said out loud, and wished Cappy was there to laugh at my bad joke. I dragged myself to the door and knocked, rattling the loose screen in its aluminum frame. She appeared behind it.
Joe, you snuck up on me.
She touched the screen, frowning at it, shook it.
I gotta fix this. Come in, Joe.
Her dog started barking too late. He ran up the hill from a field below the sloping ledge of yard where the house sat. By the time he reached the house, he was wheezing, a stumpy old black dog with a whitened face.
Buster smiles, said Linda.
He lolled out his tongue, grinning and panting in a comical way. I thought of how I'd heard people look like their dog. It was true. Linda let him in with me.
I suppose we shouldn't be laughing, considering what happened, she said, as she led me into her kitchen. Sit down, Joe. What can I get you?
She listed everything she had, every kind of drink and sandwich possibility. I didn't stop her. Finally, Linda said she was fond of a fried egg sandwich with horseradish mayonnaise.
and that if I picked that one, she'd make it for the both of us. I said that sounded good. While she was frying up the egg, she told me. I could look around, and so I wandered into the living room and took in the odd order of her place. At my house, although we kept it neat enough, there were always piles of papers and other interesting stuff here and there, or books that had gotten off the shelves. Not everything was put away immediately. There might be a jacket draped over a chair. Our shoes weren't lined up by the door. Linda's house was extremely neat in the usual way, but also in a way that disoriented me until I figured it out. Everything had a double, though not an identical. Her bookshelf had two books by each author, not the same book, though sometimes a hardback with its companion paperback. They were mostly historical romances. She had chosen collections of objects to display, also two by two. Glass figurines of Disney characters on her end tables, paired in different colors, circled the lamps on which she'd glued fake leaves sorted by the same principle. There were swamp willow baskets hanging on the wall behind the television. Each held nearly the same arrangement of dried grasses and empty seed pods. She also had a gabled Victorian dollhouse that only a grown-up could have owned. I was afraid to look inside, but did. And sure enough, every room was completely furnished down to toothpick-fine candles. And in the bathroom, two infinitesimal toothbrushes and tubes of toothpaste. I had the creeps, and we hadn't even talked. She called me back into the kitchen, and I went in, tongue-tied. We sat down at her table, which was old and made of scarred wood. At least it was the only table. There was not another almost like it. She had covered it with a bright cloth and set out plates and glasses. She poured some iced tea. The bread was toasted crisp. There was an extra plate. I pointed at it. "What's it for?" Doe told me in that sweat lodge show that since I had a double spirit around me, I should just welcome it. I set up my house for two people, see? Even the little people. And when I eat, I always set out an extra plate, and I put a bit of the food I'm eating on it. There was a crust of bread on the plate. Spirits don't eat much. "Not this one," said Linda comfortably. And suddenly it all seemed okay by me. I was hungry the way you get after an illness. Suddenly ravenous. Linda munched away, beaming at me, then at the sandwich. She put the eggy bread down, almost lovingly, and addressed it. "Is it a sin to enjoy you when my own twin brother is lying dead in a morgue? I don't know. But you sure taste good." I gulped. The other sandwich made a lump in my throat. "Wash it down with some tea?" She poured a bit more into my glass from a plastic pitcher bobbing with cut lemons and ice. "I didn't take off work to mourn. You know me better than that," she said. "I took off work for other reasons. I had sick leave coming, so I thought, hey, I'll use this time to straighten a few things out." "What things?" I thought of her neatly duplicate living room, but then I knew she meant her thoughts. "I'll tell you," said Linda, "if you'll tell me why you came here." I put down my sandwich, wishing I had eaten it all before we got to this. "Wait," said Linda, as if she read my mind. She said that we should eat first and talk later. She apologized for being a bad hostess. Then she lifted her food in her chubby little hands, the sharp nails newly shellacked, and gave me such a look. It was a merry twinkle, but at the same time it suggested insanity. I ate slowly, but eventually I had to take the final bite. Linda patted her lips with her paper napkin and folded it into squares. "The golf course," she said. "You pumped me for information." She wagged her finger at me. 2 and 2 makes 3. "However, I have decided that you are too young to have accomplished this. Maybe you're not, but I've decided you are. My theory is you gave the information about Linden golfing to someone older, but someone nearsighted, not your father. Your father is a very good shot."
"He is?"
This was, of course, a big surprise to me. Everybody knows that. He brought down anything he aimed at as a young man. Kids don't know their parents' history. What did you come here for?
Can I trust you?
If you have to ask me that, no.
I was stuck.
That mad sparkle came back and lighted up her tiny round eyes. She seemed about to explode with laughter. Instead, she leaned toward me and peered around, as if the walls were bugged. Then she whispered,
I would do anything in the world for your family. I am devoted to you guys. Though you've been using me, Joe, and you want something from me now, what is it?
Right then I thought I was going to ask about the rifle. Instead, I heard myself ask the question I knew had no answer.
Why, Linda? Why did he do it?
I caught her off guard. Her eyes bulged and filled. But she answered. She answered like she thought it was so obvious I wouldn't need to ask.
He hated your family, I mean, your father mostly, but Whitey and Sonia too. His thinking was all crooked, Joe. He hated your father, but he was afraid of him. Still, he wouldn't have come for Geraldine except for he became a monster when it came to Mela.
By filling out that form in Geraldine's office, Mela had named old Yelto as father of her child, meaning she got pregnant while she worked for him. A high school girl. From that old lech. Excuse me, she got a car to travel home with and payoff money not to talk, but she still insisted on enrolling her baby. Lyndon worked for the governor, but he was always jealous, always possessive, sick, smitten to death with Mela. He wanted to run away with her on that money, and here she won't share. Won't go with him. Probably hates him. Scared of him. Tries to get Geraldine to help her, so now both of them know the truth. All this eats at him. He idolized Yelto. Maybe he thought if he had had that file, he'd save Yelto. Or maybe he'd blackmail Yelto.
I could see him doing either. And of course your mother wouldn't give him that file.
But why he did this to your mother had more to do with the man who set loose his monster. Not everybody's got a monster, and most who do keep it locked up. But I saw the monster in my brother way back in the hospital, and it made me deathly ill. I knew that someday he would let it loose. It would lurch out with part of me inside. Yes, I was part of the monster too. I gave and gave. But know what? It was still hungry. Know why? Because no matter how much it ate, it couldn't get the right thing. There was always something it needed. Something missing in his mother, too. I'll tell you what it was. Me. My powerful spirit. Me. His mother couldn't face what she did to her baby. But even more, that what she did could not destroy me. Still, Linda brooded. She could call me after telling the doctor to let me die. All those years later, call me and say, hello, it's your mother. I was silent. And he could not let go, she said at last. Because he came back, and he came back like he wanted. His monster killed. Though another reason has occurred to me also.
What's that?
He was nervous about Mela.
I just know she's somewhere on the reservation.
He had to keep checking on her, make sure she wasn't found.
Do you think she's alive?
No. After a while, dread stole into me. I asked,
am I like him?
No, she said.
This'll get to you. Or whoever I mean. This could wreck you. Don't let it wreck you, Joe.
What could you do? Or whoever do? She shrugged.
But me? That's another story. It's me who is not so different, Joe. It's me who should have shot him with Albert's old 12-gauge.
Though if Lyndon had his druthers, I think he'd rather have got shot with the deer rifle.
Yeah, it's about that rifle, I said.
The rifle.
It's under your porch.
Can you hide it?
Get it off the reservation? She grinned at me in a way fit to burst, and I thought, crazy. But then she bit her lip modestly and blinked.
Buster found it already, Joe.
He knows when anything new enters his territory. I thought he was interested in a skunk. Then I looked underneath and saw the edge of that black hefty bag. She saw my shot.